I'm Brandi Cruz. Coming up today on Undivided, I'm starting to think our state's massive budget deficit is just about the best thing that could happen to state government. Plus, would you vote for a candidate who previously supported police defunding? We'll discuss and hear from subscribers also. The Ninth Circuit says King County cannot interfere with federal deportations. That and more coming up today on Undivided. Remember, you can support our show for just $5 a month by signing up at undividedpod.com. You can also gift a subscription to Undivided to a friend or family member who might benefit from it. Patreon.com/undivided/gift. Hello, hello, and welcome to Undivided on this Tuesday. Thank you for being here. Thank you so much for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. You know what? This budget deficit thing is growing on me. I kind of like it. I kind of love it. I keep finding all these little silver linings in our state facing a $10 to $12 billion budget deficit. I talked about a few of them on the show previously. One of them being, hopefully, there aren't all these new insane laws passed because the Democratic majority is so focused on trying to figure out the budget deficit. And the same thing with Bob Ferguson, that he can't push through anything insane because he's going to get into office and be faced with a $10 to $12 billion budget deficit. So, like, they can't pass dumb programs that are wasteful spending because they don't have any money to do it. So part me is like, okay, that's a really good thing. But the realization I came to today, it's kind of like forced participation in DOGE, you know, because they're going to do DOGE at the federal level, the Department of Government Efficiency, and they're going to go in there and slash and cut and all these things. We kind of are forced to participate in it as well. Now, they can decide to a certain extent how much of that revenue they want to dare to make up with new revenue and new taxes on people, and how much they're actually going to have to go in and slash wasteful spending. We know Governor Inslee has already directed his state agencies to look at ways that they can reduce spending, and he's cutting things that should have never existed to begin with. You know, around DEI and all these, you know, feel-good government programs, or, you know, a website he created to be accountable to the public that he never really even used. So it's a good exercise in getting rid of things that are wasteful spending. Now, of course, you know, there's a distinct possibility that they also try to supplement the deficit with increased taxes, but I also see a silver lining there. I would kind of love for one of the first things that Bob Ferguson has to do as the new governor to be to increase taxes. Like in his very first couple months on the job, I would love for him to have to be forced to do that and live with it and be forced to do it as a result of Democrats not having any ability to budget and having a very clear spending problem, because that's the result of this. Our friends over at the Center Square had a good breakdown you should go read. It's from TJ Martinell, the Center Square, that shows just how out of control our state's budget has been over the last 10 years and in turn our state's spending. All this money coming in. Some of it they knew from sources that might not be reliable for years to come. But they just, if the money's in, they're like, I gotta spend it. My dad used to say, you got money burning a hole in your pocket. Whenever we, you know, got like a little money, I used to get money from my dad for picking up cigarette butts. So then I'd have money burning a hole in my pocket because I just want to find a way to spend it. That was state government. It wasn't about like, hey, maybe we shouldn't dedicate this to programs that are going to be around for 30 years because this spending and this revenue stream might not be around for 30 years, but they just couldn't help themselves. They had your money burning a hole in their pocket. So the Center Square posted this article, go read it. Washington State's spending spree drives massive deficit. And make no mistake, that's what it is. This isn't a budget deficit in the traditional sense brought about by some sort of economic hardship. This is a spending problem. As the Center Square points out, since 2013, the state operating budget has increased from $38.4 billion to $75.5 billion. A $37 billion increase that has nearly doubled spending. Over 10 years. A $37 billion increase. Think about that in terms of what the government should be doing, the role of the government. Does the government really have twice the responsibilities to its citizens that it did 10 years ago? No, it just created things, responsibilities it wanted to take. They wanted to grow the size of government. And so that's what they did. It's not like the citizens of Washington have two times more things they need from the government than they did 10 years ago. And then you also look at, of course, wait, you have two times the money? And virtually every measure of success is worse including the climate, by the way. Two times more money, worse crime, worse homelessness, worse substance abuse, a completely dilapidated mental health system, worse transportation, on all worse affordability, in a housing crisis. On all these measures, you actually did worse with twice the money. Like, that's genuinely embarrassing, right? Now, part of this in the increase, to be fair, part of the massive increase in revenue to the state, taxes, and spending was because, if you recall, and you've lived in our state for some time, there was something called the McCleary decision, which mandated that our state fully fund basic education. So that meant, according to the court, we were going to have to spend a ton more money on education. So from the Center Square, the 2011-2013 operating budget invested $17.7 billion into K-12. By 2019, in part because of McCleary, it increased to $28.7 billion. That's insane. $28.7 billion. Under the budget right now, $32.4 billion is spent on public schools. $32.4 billion. So again, compare that to 2011 to 2013, $17.7 billion. So about 10 years ago, we were spending $17.7 billion on K-12. Now we're spending $32.4 billion. And guess what? Our educational outcomes are worse. And in fact, our enrollment is down. So we're doing with about double the money, not quite double, almost double the money. Our test scores are worse. People are fleeing public schools. So again, this is the theme, right? Doubled spending in all these areas only for worse outcomes. And people keep sending those same people back to Olympia. And, you know, when you talk about worse outcomes, you know, a bulk of that money went to paying teachers more. It went to bureaucracy. It went to staff positions in districts, again, from the Center Square. The state has increased education employees significantly since 2011, with a 25% increase in teaching staff, a 42% increase in school principals, and a 66% increase in non-teacher staff positions. Yeah. So obviously, that hasn't increased outcomes for kids. That's what you always hear from the teachers' unions when they're like, we need more money, we need more support staff, and this is about the kids. If it were about the kids, I feel like the kids would be doing better in school. So look, you guys already know this. You already know that we're spending more money than ever and our outcomes are worse than ever. And so maybe this is an opportunity to cut the fat and to refocus on the things that the government really ought to be doing and really ought to be focusing on, right? So, you know, all this increased spending, of course, that money just doesn't come out of thin air. They have passed an insane number of new taxes. The Center Square listed some of these. First of all, we know capital gains tax. So if we look between 2011 and now, you can take that down, Nicole. Capital gains tax, long-term care tax, Climate Commitment Act. They increased the hazardous waste tax, imposed a business and occupation tax surcharge to pay for higher education programs, tax on vaping products, changed the real estate excise tax, an additional 1.2% B&O tax. So they've been increasing taxes like crazy over the last 10 years to account for that massive increase. Now, something I said on the show last week that the Center Square actually quoted, at the time in 2019, our economy was doing great in 2019 in Washington State. Our economy in Washington State was absolutely humming right along. And you could look at that if you're a bad budgeter and you could say, oh my God, great, we're going to get all this money in. We're just going to push it out the door. Well, Republicans were saying, don't do that. Republicans were saying, things are great. Now is an awesome time to save some money and stash some money away for a rainy day, like you probably do if you have a little unexpected income. You know, add to your savings account. And they also said, or in the alternative, there's a lot of states, even blue states, that are, God forbid, giving people a tax rebate, sending checks to people saying, hey, our economy is doing great. We have more money than we need. Have some of your money back. And Democrats said, no, we can't do that. This was a quote from Representative Drew Stokesbury back in 2019. I am deeply troubled that the majority believes this level of spending growth is sustainable. In times of prosperity, we should be focused on building reserves to prevent the devastating cuts that were required after the last economic downturn. So Republicans 100% warned of this exact situation that we're in right now. Like, hey guys, I know things are great. I know you'd love to spend all this money that's coming in. We ought to save it, or we ought to give it back to people. Democrats said, no, we can't do that. We've made all these promises and all these programs, and we can't do that. So not only did they keep spending money, actually after that in 2019, they continued to pass new taxes. Like, think of those three big new taxes: long-term care tax, capital gains tax, What is the one I'm missing? CCA, Climate Commitment Act, that they pushed through. That's not a tax per se, but it costs you money at the gas pump, right? So it wasn't even enough for them. They were like, no, they got drunk on money. They got drunk on money that they were doling out to all their political allies to enrich them and not solve anything that the state was doing. And they were like, oh my God, we can make more money if we tax here and here and here and here. So this is all going on. I think it's a good thing. I think it's silver lining. I am looking forward to seeing how Bob Ferguson deals with it. He's not going to be able to make good on any of his campaign promises. And we'll see. Hopefully they don't turn to new taxes. Hopefully they've learned their lesson over the last 10 years. And they'll actually go in and slash. Again, forced DOGE, forced participation in DOGE might be a very good thing. But then you look at, again, one of the downsides, I guess, is if you were wary that they were going to be able to deal with the homeless crisis or the drug crisis or the crime crisis already, now you should be very, very, very skeptical. Because if they couldn't do it in great budget times, in great economic times, spending billions of dollars, then they're certainly not going to be able to do it now when they have a budget shortfall. This is from the Washington State Standard, just as one example of this. So you know that home sales have been slowing. Well, there is a fee when if you go to the county auditor's office. It's a recording fee, and it helps fund programs to deal with homelessness. Well, okay, if you're selling less homes, then that fund is going to be smaller. This from the Washington State Standard. Fees that pay for WA homelessness programs running short. The Department of Commerce anticipates a nearly $403 million shortfall in fee revenue that goes toward programs like emergency shelter grants, temporary rent assistance, and support for homeless youth. This money is from document recording fees people pay when they file real estate deeds and other paperwork with county auditors. That's another example of poor planning, poor budgeting. Like, hey, we've got a program that's basically funded through fees that can be very variable, that can have ups and downs depending on the real estate market. So yeah, we ought to prepare and stash some money away in the common sense eventuality that our real estate market slows down a little bit because we really need these programs. So we certainly shouldn't be funding them through such a variable program. So again, if we were at all skeptical, which I already didn't think they were going to be able to fix it because the same party is not going to be able to fix the problems it created. But if you had any sort of like hope, like, okay, all right, maybe, you know, homelessness has gotten so bad, crime's gotten so bad, drug abuse has gotten so bad that they're going to really get down to business and do this. We got a new governor in. Well, now they don't have even near the, they're not going to have even near the money that they've had to try to deal with it. So you really think they're going to fix it? No, nothing's going to get better. So a lot of silver linings, I think, in the budget deficit, but also some harsh realities that if they couldn't problem solve with the money they already had, they're certainly not going to be able to problem solve now. All right, moving on, I want to talk about the race for King County Executive. If you live outside of Washington State, I know some of you do. This is the county that houses Seattle. And so honestly, you know, Seattle, King County, the Seattle mayor, the King County Executive kind of work in tandem. They tend to be very progressive. Right now, we're with four-term Executive Dow Constantine, who, as you know, announced he will not be seeking. Oh, how generous of him. Will not seek a fifth term in office. Instead, he's going to hope that he lands a cushy seven-figure job as the UW president. So now, of course, you've got the names immediately after that that are coming out saying that they're going to run. And one of them is King County Councilman Girmay Zahalai. Here is his campaign video.
When my family came to the U.S. as refugees, King County gave us a chance to rebuild our lives. It became a place of hope, safety, and opportunity. A place where I could dream big and achieve more than I ever thought possible. I'm Girmay Zahalai, and I'm running for King County Executive to build a region where everyone has hope and opportunity, regardless of where you came from or the challenges that you face. King County should be a place where everyone feels safe, where housing is affordable, where healthcare is accessible, where we protect our air and our water, and where we set up our children to achieve their wildest dreams. In the face of a new federal government that will attack our values, King County must stand as a beacon of progress and unity. Together, We will defend our shared values, reject division, and ensure that our region remains a place of opportunity for everyone. Join me, and let's build a new era in King County, an era of opportunity for all.
Oh, his baby's cute. I'll give him that. That's a cute little baby. You're welcome for us airing your political ad, free ad time. Here's the deal. Besides the obviously sort of like very expected line of, Trump, running on the dangers of Donald Trump or whatever it is. So Girmay Zalhaj has been on our show before. He's a very nice man, nothing against him personally, but his politics are completely unsuited for the majority of King County. I mean, Seattle, maybe, but the rest of King County, he is far too progressive. And one of the things that has now become predictable in the last couple years is these progressive candidates to completely, again, shed an exoskeleton and pretend to be someone that they weren't just a few years ago. Girmay Zalhaj did an in-depth interview with Como News when he announced his campaign. You want to guess what issue? You want to guess what issue he's suddenly, like, going to focus on, key to his campaign? Oh, yeah, he's the public safety candidate. Ring a bell? Just like Bob Ferguson, man. All these people suddenly realizing public safety is a key issue. So I'm a public safety candidate. Como News says Girmay Zalhaj announced his run for King County Executive, says public safety is a key issue. That would be fine if we didn't have the receipts. That would be fine if we didn't know his not so far in the past statements about the police. So this is, again, a common thread. I mean, you look at Kamala Harris. She ran as president as a totally different person than she was running in 2020, because 2020, everybody was on the police defunding bandwagon on the left. They were very, very anti-police. There were riots happening all around the country that didn't seem to bother them one bit. And then Kamala Harris runs in 2024 as the border state prosecutor, It's same with Bob Ferguson. Doesn't say jack shit about police defunding and all of that and rioting and all of that, even as the state's chief law enforcer. And then he comes out and he's like, I'm the public safety candidate. So forgive me, Girmay Zalhaj, if I just have a hard time believing that that public safety is truly going to be a key issue for you and one that you are able to actually address in the way that it needs to be addressed. Because, so just as an example, the council member was on, this is June 12th, 2020. What was happening June 12th, 2020? It was the formation of CHOP. So we were going through these riots, not only across the country, but in Seattle as well, these intense clashes in the lead up to the formation of the occupied protest zone between protesters and the police. Well, Girmay Zalhaj went on a podcast called Pitchfork Economics. This is June 12th. Here's what he said about what was happening up on Capitol Hill and also how he believed it tied to the pandemic that was happening at the time as well.
You know, there are some people who don't really see the connection between COVID-19 and what happened to George Floyd. I think those are two very similar dynamics. Those are generations of unjust and unsustainable policies impacting marginalized communities, Black and brown communities, and playing out with death of a Black individual, George Floyd, or death of countless Black and brown people at the hands of a virus that disproportionately affects us. And so that's what I've been seeing play out, an unsustainable society and the masses that no longer want to live under these conditions, and people are rising up. That's what played out on Capitol Hill on Saturday night. It was incredible and powerful to see. To provide contrast, on one side, you see people taking care of one another. And on the other side, I just see what looks like a militarized police force, riot gear, shields, batons for beating people. You look on the tops of buildings and you see more officers on the tops of buildings. And I saw pictures later where there were what appeared to be assault rifles or some kind of weapons that they had on the roof. And it's just a sight that will stick with me probably for the rest of my life, because I see what the protesters have been saying, and that is that our police forces are not the kinds of public safety systems that we want to see right now.
Yeah, so that was June 12th, 2020. And now fast forward 4 years and he's running for King County Executive with public safety as a key focus. Do you think that someone who had that kind of rhetoric toward police officers is believable as a public safety candidate 4 years later? I mean, I certainly don't. And I would also note, after he said that, talking about how powerful it was and how militarized the police, and oh my God, God forbid the police have guns. Well, it was just a few days later that the police evacuated that area and that the area was taken over by left-wing rioters with what? semi-automatic assault weapons that were handed to them out of the trunk of a car. And you saw very, very few elected leaders speak out about that. But oh God, if a police have the guns that they're legally allowed to have and they use for their job, totally terrible, scary. And it's like, oh, but you know, the chop warlord hands guns out of the trunk of his car. Like, oh, they're protecting their new occupied protest zone. And of course, people went on to be murdered at CHOP, not by the police. The people who died at CHOP were not killed by the police. They were killed by the left-wing lunatics who were at CHOP. And so, you know, I look forward, and we've reached out to Ghurmay Zahalai already today, and I look forward to next year having him on the show. I think it's a little early now, maybe after the legislative session, to talk to him about some of those statements he made in the lead-up to CHOP, to talk to him about some of those statements he made about the police. He also said on that exact same podcast what his priorities in terms of criminal justice reform were going to be.
Number one, demilitarize the police. Number two, further restrict use of excessive or deadly force by police. Number three, increase accountability and transparency in police union contracts and that negotiation process. Number four, give subpoena and other investigative powers to independent oversight boards. And number five, redirect police department funding to community-based alternatives.
AKA defund the police. So he supported police defunding. He supported divesting money from the King County Sheriff's Office into community alternatives, which we know were a farce, which we know were a money grab, which we know were given millions of dollars in taxpayer funds, essentially as a bribe to stop the riots and the protests. That's what happened. I mean, how many of them, you go to the streets are, like Andre Jones, was it Andre Jones? Was that his name? Andre Taylor. Andre Jones was someone I went to college with. I think that's why I had that come up. Andre Taylor, the street czar, got this lucrative government contract, then didn't do anything. Some of these other entities, that it was literally just a bribe. It was like the city's like, just take money and go away, right? Stop calling us racist, stop rioting, stop, you know, burning buildings and police cars and all of this stuff. He supported that, though. He supported, at a time of high crime has only gotten worse, divesting money away from law enforcement, which is already stretched thin, which was already the lowest per capita of any state in the nation, and giving it to these community organizations that were not held accountable. And continue to not be held accountable for those funds. It just made everyone feel good, right? And so now, 4 years later, can you really believe him when he says that he is looking at the public safety issue in a different way? I asked that in our daily subscriber show poll, which we'll get to later on, but please take it if you haven't already on Patreon, Locals, and X, about, are you willing to vote for someone who supported police defunding if they have since walked away from that position? And how much time has to pass? The other thing, but this is there's a larger issue here, which I'll get to in a moment. He also supported closing the youth jail, you know, when the youth jail construction trailers were being lit on fire in the summer of 2020, and they were, no youth jail. Well, a lot of politicians jumped on that bandwagon, you know, can't put kids in cages, of course, because we said that was bad during Trump, so we can't put even the worst of even young people committing horrific crimes. No youth jail. Got to close down the youth jail. I'll give credit to Como News because they did ask him about that. They asked him about his previous position on closing the youth jail because he has walked away from it. So as for why he supported it in the first place, he said, you know, I go and talk to these young people in confinement. They tell me they leave there feeling dizzy and disoriented and unable to manage their emotions. And that's probably why we see such a high rate of recidivism when it comes to young people impacted by our criminal justice system. He went on to say, of course, he's backed away from the position of closing the jail. He said, we absolutely need secure buildings. And so what I'm advocating now is to make sure that we have secure buildings, but also let's transform what happens within those secure buildings. So that's a fine position. I've always been consistent kind of with that position that, like, yeah, you have to have secure facilities for juveniles who commit horrible crimes. But also, they're juveniles. I agree with the notion that maybe their brain's not fully formed yet. It doesn't mean I don't think they should be held accountable. But while you got them, you know, 99.9% of them are going to get out someday unless they've committed, you know, aggravated first-degree murder and been charged as an adult. So let's make sure that we are tailoring programs to young people so that they can turn their lives around when they get out. But here's the issue with that. Like, that's always been my position. And I'm not saying I haven't changed opinions on things over the years, but never something like that. supporting police defunding and turning around 4 years later and saying, no, I don't do that. I don't support that anymore. Supporting closing a youth jail during a juvenile crime crisis and turning around and saying, no, now I support sort of this more nuanced approach to it. To me, what it shows, and I don't know how old Girmay Zahalai is. You know, one of the things I've admitted that at 36, I'm still forming my opinions on things. I'm also not running to be the King County executive. I'm also not running at 36 for public office while I'm still forming my worldview a little bit. It shows an immaturity, in a way, to jump on the bandwagon of what people are demanding in the moment. And to not sit there as a leader and say, look, I know you want this and I know you want that. I know you have this long laundry list of things that you're taking to the streets to demand, but here's why that's not feasible. I hear you, I understand you, but here's why that's not feasible. So a little bit of immaturity, but also there's older politicians who have exhibited the same sort of thing. Bob Ferguson, Kamala Harris. So it's not just an age issue. I think it's a first and foremost being driven by ideology, but also being incapable of saying no. I think it shows someone who is incapable of saying no to bad ideas, even when it might hurt them politically, especially when it could hurt them politically. You know, I have the utmost respect for leaders and politicians who are willing to say no to the worst impulses of their own party. And I have not seen that from Girmay Zahalai. I have not seen that from Bob Ferguson. There are a lot of Democrats, and I'm not saying there aren't Republicans too, who have shown that they're incapable of saying no to the worst impulses of their own party, even when they know that what their own party is pushing or where the fringes of their own party are pushing is a really bad idea. And that, to me, doesn't equate to a good leader because you don't know what you're going to get from them on any given day. There's an unpredictability there that's really, really troubling. I'll also say, hi, Lucky. Nicole, you want to take a two shot? My dogs are here today. Lucky's over there just harassing Nicole. I just couldn't leave him at home today. I couldn't leave him there. So they came in today. Lucky, show your cute little face. She's cute. What I was also saying, and I don't know if you saw this, Nicole, he says he would not disband the King County region. Oh, there she is. Good job, Locke.
There you go.
She loves Nicole. She loves her Aunt Nicole.
Pretty.
A little dog time during the show today. He also says he wouldn't disband the King County Regional Homelessness Authority. Nicole's like, why are you bringing your dogs? Yeah, look, I couldn't leave them at home. I don't know how long I'm going to be at work today. Lucky, come over here. He also says that he wouldn't disband the King County Regional Homelessness Authority, which to me is a non-starter. I mean, there are even Democrats who have been very skeptical of that program. And to me, when you see a program that has gotten billions of dollars, right, and you've seen that it's not working, what does it say if you won't disband it? After how many years do you have to see that it's not working to say, okay, we've got to try something else? Because again, the goal is to help the homeless, right? Right? The goal is to help the homeless, right? You would think, not to enrich like your cronies and allies, if the goal is truly to help the homeless, which I want to believe it is, then we absolutely need to make sure that that money is being used to that effect and that you're having outcomes. So whether you're left, right, or center, if you care about helping the homeless, then the King County Regional Homeless Authority has already proven that it is not the solution. So anyway, the race for King County Executive is going to be something we talk about with more frequency. But I just have a problem with, we saw this nationally, we saw it in statewide elections with Bob Ferguson, we're going to see it here. I fundamentally have an issue with anyone who just a few years ago supported police defunding and wants us to believe that they're the person to trust with public safety issues. And again, we look forward. We've already reached out to Girmay Zahalai. I look forward to having him on the show to talk about these issues. We've had him on the show before to talk about police defunding. All right. If you're thinking about selling your home at some point this year, because like I just said, home sales are pretty slow right now, and that's leading to the de facto defunding, apparently, of this money that's supposed to help with homelessness. And I can't tell if that's a good thing or a bad thing, because the money that's going to these programs isn't being spent well. But Wes Jones and his team, they have an innovative marketing strategy to make sure that the most possible eyeballs get on your listing, to make sure it really is shining when it hits the market. So if you need some cosmetic upgrades, for instance, not only can they help you manage those projects, which is great because it takes a ton of stress off an already stressful situation of trying to move, but they can also help you pay for it up front, which is really cool too if you just don't have the cash out of pocket to make some of the upgrades that they maybe think that you need to make. So check out our friend Wes Jones, sellwithwes.com, sellwithwes.com, a better way to sell your home. All right. Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals has issued, shockingly, a great ruling in the favor of common sense, saying that King County cannot interfere with federal deportations. Let's talk about it in our segment, Unbelievable. Once in a while, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals gets some sanity in there every once in a while. So I'm not totally willing to dismiss them out of hand because this is a good one. So first, a little background here. So in 2019, you might have remembered that King County Executive Dow Constantine wanted to stop ICE from using the King County Airport as a place to have deportation flights come and go from. Of course, because we're a sanctuary county, and he's like, we're not going to have ICE in here flying in flights and flying out flights of people who are being deported. This is from April 23rd, 2019. Executive Constantine directs actions against ICE detainee flights from King County Airport. He signed an order that directed King County International Airport to amend lease practices with the goal of banning flights of immigration detainees chartered by Immigration and Customs Enforcement. The action applied to companies that operate hangar space and other facilities. Meanwhile, King County International Airport will update its rules to make ICE flights more transparent. So basically, the goal here was we do not want ICE to be able to use the King County International Airport or anybody who leases hangar space or whatever it is to allow ICE to deport people via plane from the country. So after that, the Department of Justice sued King County, because remember, this is still under the Trump administration, and so that's where this conflict was happening. So again, probably a precursor for the kind of conflicts that are going to happen in the second Trump administration. So the Justice Department sued King County and King County executive personally, I mean, in his capacity as executive, for prohibiting U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement contractors from using King County International Airport. They said after the executive order was issued, the company providing fixed-based operator services to ICE's contractor at Boeing Field informed the contractor that it would no longer service its flights, and no other FBO, which is a fixed-base operator, agreed to assist the contractor. As a result of similar refusals at other airports in the Seattle area, ICE's contractor has been forced to relocate these flights to Yakima, Washington. This has created significant operational difficulties and additional costs for ICE. So the federal government, again, under Trump, sued over it, saying, you know, we can't operate these flights. It's a huge inconvenience to have to move it to Yakima. And I'm happy to report that the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals agrees. This is from their ruling. The panel held that the executive order violated the intergovernmental immunity doctrine because the executive order improperly regulated the way in which the federal government transported non-citizen detainees by preventing ICE from using contractors at Boeing Field, and on its face discriminated against the United States by singling out the federal government and its contractors for unfavorable treatment. Good. It's good stuff right there. So that undercuts any hope or desire that Dow Constantine might have had in the first year in 2025 is his last year in office, and then whoever takes over after him, from trying to stop detainee flights in this way. I have no doubt that we're going to continue to see lawsuits from sanctuary states that seek in some way to shield illegal immigrants via our state sanctuary policies. But at least when it comes to ICE operating flights for their detainees, their federal detainees, non-citizens out of the country, Boeing Field on the table. I gotta love that one. That is a very, very sane ruling from the Ninth Circuit.
It's a little frustrating how long it took.
It is, although I'm actually surprised, and I will admit I don't fully know the process that goes into there, but this lawsuit was brought about by Trump's Department of Justice. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of surprised that Biden's Department of Justice didn't just say, never mind. Because they could, in theory, right? I mean,
I don't know.
I don't think there would be any reason if you filed a lawsuit you couldn't unfile it or drop it. So I'm kind of surprised that it survived the Biden administration. That's kind of odd to me, but who cares?
Yeah.
Here we are. And, you know, maybe it's possible that the Department of Justice knew that the Trump administration would do it again, and then they'd be back in the same situation, and they'd have lost all this time. So maybe they just, you know, continue down that course, which is possible. But this is really good news. It's sane, and we're going to continue to see all of these issues come to head. That is going to be, I think, one of the most significant storylines in Washington State and other sanctuary states over the next 4 years. So this is just the beginning of that, but I think a really good ruling for common sense. To think that King County Executive Dow Constantine could say at this airport, the federal government flying federal detainees, nothing to do with this state, can't do that from this airport. That's insane. All right, I've encouraged you guys to take the First Mark challenge. Why? It is also common sense. There's no reason not to do it. We all need insurance. You can't just get rid of it to save money. But you can go to an experienced real estate broker who's been doing this in our area for a long time and have them just look over your insurance. Talk to them about your insurance needs. They'll go out, they'll shop the market, they'll see if they can save you a little money, if they can get you better insurance, or if you're paying for insurance that you don't even need. That was the case for Mike and I when we took the First Mark challenge. We were underinsured overall, but we had insurance we didn't need in some areas that we were able to cut. So firstmarkinsurance.com, firstmarkinsurance.com. You could be the next First Mark challenge victory. We've heard in recent weeks from Karina, Tanya, Michelle, Paula, all of them saying and sharing wonderful stories about taking the First Mark challenge. In some instances, they were able to save thousands of dollars a year. The challenge is free, and you never pay First Mark Insurance anything for their services. So it just really is a no-brainer. Just do it. Just do it. FirstMarkInsurance.com, FirstMarkInsurance.com. The very best part is they work for you. All right, really quickly with National, I just have to, the whole felon, Trump's a felon, so you know, the felon, the people who support the felon can't be mad that Biden pardoned his son. Oh my God, it's exhausting. There was one tweet in particular. So the whole pardon thing, I'm already exhausted by it. But one tweet in particular that really stuck out to me that I want to talk about. So it came from Representative Eric Swalwell, a Democrat. He said, if you defended the 34-time felon who committed sexual assault, stole national security documents, and tried running a coup on his country, you can sit out the Hunter Biden pardon discussion. So this to me, it just illustrates the entire point. I don't understand that Democrats don't get that. This to me illustrates the entire point of why Donald Trump got elected. Donald Trump is never the one who has acted holier than thou. Donald Trump has never pretended to be, has never suggested that he is morally superior and never does anything wrong and absolutely like has, you know, complete moral clarity. Democrats are the ones who are always on their high horse, truly, nationally, always on their high horse. It was Democrats and Joe Biden. When Joe Biden said, I'm not going to pardon Hunter. And Karine Jean-Pierre said it over and over. He's not going to do it. He's not going to do it. And then the talking heads on MSNBC would get on and CNN and applaud the president for his moral clarity. This is what it's like to be a leader. That's a tough decision for him to make, but it's the right decision and celebrate him. But the problem is that was never the decision he was going to make. He acts morally righteous, but then he pretends to be morally righteous when he's actually not. That's the issue. Like, Trump is not a perfect person. Trump does and says things that are completely outside traditionally accepted norms for a politician. But he never acts like someone he's not. And for the American people, there's some like comfort in that, I think. But like, you're not going to get someone who says 100 times they won't pardon their son and then turns around at the first opportunity and not only pardons their son, but offers their son a sweeping pardon over a decade. And I see that oftentimes, you know, that's one of my biggest complaints with the whole January 6th narrative, right? Where Democrats want to act like, and they keep going back to, yeah, but January 6th. Yeah, but January 6th. Yeah, but January 6th. After they ignored like 2 years of left-wing rioting. After they actually participated in civil unrest in Seattle in the summer of 2020, where cop cars were burned and a police precinct was taken over and people were killed and all of this. So they did that all through 2020. And then January 6th happened. And it's like, oh my God, the right and all of this. Well, they just totally, we have the moral high ground ignoring the fact that they were silent on all the left-wing rioting. So that's the issue, is like the high horse that the Democrats, many nationally, sit on. And they believe that they have the moral high ground. So you have someone like Rep. Eric Swalwell, well, if you defended a 30-time, four-time felon, you can sit out the Hunter Biden pardon discussion. It drives me freaking nuts. And I think until they grasp that, they're not going to be able to recover from the Trump thing, because they continue to sit on this high horse, even though they lost disastrously at the national level. They won't admit. I mean, there's so many defending Biden for this. As Nicole and I said, we probably would have pardoned our son too, but we wouldn't have lied about it for months on end. We wouldn't have had our staffers lie about it for months on end. So that's the thing that's really at the heart of this. And so it's like, oh, if you supported Trump, you can't talk about Biden. No, this is exactly what we're talking about. It's ridiculous. All right, I asked you guys in our daily subscriber show poll, would you vote for a candidate who previously supported police defunding, but has since backed away from that position? Nicole, would you? Yes or no?
Well, no. No.
What if it was 10 years?
I guess that there is some element, but I'm just... anybody that wanted to do that at some point probably isn't going to be my candidate. But I'm saying that hypothetically. So I'm not saying that it's a disqualifying thing in the moment, but I'm saying somebody that thought that once is probably not going to be my candidate on a lot of issues.
I tend to agree. And I just, it's a disqualifier for me. If you had that's such poor judgment.
And I don't.
It shows such poor judgment. And so if that was your position, and I've said all along, 100%, I'd be in favor of police defunding if we lived in a utopia. If we had this massive police force and virtually no crime, let's take some of that money and put it elsewhere. I don't need this monstrous police force if there's no reason for it, but that's not the world we're living in.
Right.
So if you're talking about utopia, they want to pull out the rug from underneath law enforcement. Oh, to these community alternatives when they have rampant crime and they don't even have the community alternative set up. So let's see. Not a surprise. Subscribers saying 89% saying no. I would not consider voting for someone it's hard to get past.
It's hard to believe that their minds have changed that much, I guess.
In such a short period of time, especially. Mm-hmm. Cheryl says, wouldn't trust them. May says, I would have trouble voting for someone who supported police defunding and now doesn't because I have trouble believing them. Yeah, so it's a credibility issue. Pete, no, because they are a brainless zombie liberal and only do what the Democratic Party says to do. And that's kind of the point I made earlier that Pete's making here is this shows someone who blows with the wind, right? Because that is a significant shift. It's not like, I'm trying to think of a less problematic shift. It's not like, I'm trying to think of a shift that would be okay. You know, like on drugs or something. Like not full decriminalization, but it's such a dramatic shift from a previous position in just a few years that it's unbelievable. It's hard to actually believe that they've made such a substantial shift. Even my Trump shift, right? It was very gradual over time. It was okay, I don't like the guy. To all right, I see what the media is kind of doing to the guy. And then it was okay, now they're trying to kill the guy. So now I see the media problem. So that is a substantial shift, but it wasn't I woke up one day and was I'm voting for Donald Trump. It was 4 years of slowly coming to the realization that he was their scapegoat for everything. And so it's I don't want to be vilified for my previous Trump position because I feel I've been very transparent. But I think it's a much different thing when you wake up one day and you're suddenly running for office and you're saying, now I don't support police defunding. And it's something that had such disastrous impacts for a community.
Right. And you made that decision over time with these, it was maybe an educated decision you came to, right? Whereas when he was asking to divest them and defund or whatever he was trying to do with it, it was at its height,
right?
Our county was a mess at the time, and so he's not pointing to he is pointing, and I saw a couple quotes about this. He was saying, I've heard from people who don't like that idea. But once you get into office, you still have that idea, right? Because you haven't changed your opinion. You're just listening to people in order to get elected, or you've actually made some educational decision on this.
You don't know the motivation. If they can be swayed that much by a loud minority of people, right? Then what's to say that a year into office, they won't be swayed by another loud minority of people?
Right.
So it's that lack of strength to just stick to their convictions and say, right. I mean, I'm not saying don't take feedback from the public. I think you should take feedback Absolutely. From the people you serve. But you also have to have a good barometer of whether that feedback is representative of at least the majority of the people you serve. And right. I think that's been the issue is too often, if you're the loudest voice and you can scream the loudest or do the most crazy stuff, you get your way. And that just can't be the way that we govern. And that can't be the way a politician makes decisions. Let's see here from Brian, it would depend on who they were running against. If the opponent was even further to the left, then I probably would have to. Michelle, one caveat, they have actually done something significant or meaningful to prove that they have changed their position, not just verbal. Okay, I see that. So it's like not just words, it's action.
Right. And I would see, you know, if he came out and said, hey, you know, my family was a victim of a crime and I'm recognizing now that we have this, you know, it's personal, right? Yeah. He's made it personal and said, this is why I've made this decision because I recognize this, you know, breakdown in society or whatever yeah. it is. Then you could say, okay, I see how your heart might have changed on that issue.
Yeah.
But he's literally just saying, oh, okay, I've heard from the public. Well, no, that just tells me that you could change back once you get what you want.
Yeah, and I think there's also an aspect of when you've made such a miscalculation, right? Mm-hmm. And like on the pandemic, I talked about this a lot. Had the governor come out after some of these things and said, hey, you know, we were wrong. We were wrong about the vaccines and what we thought they were going to do. So we issued a mandate. It was the wrong thing to do, given the information we have. We're going to make things right with the employees that were impacted by it or whatever it is. But when there's no real like humility and a clear showing of introspection and coming out and admitting mistakes in a very like humble, honest way, I do think it's really hard to believe that you won't, as Nicole said, just turn around and do the same thing again at a moment's notice on something as significant as a vaccine mandate or as significant as police defunding. Mm-hmm. And we're still dealing with the impacts of police defunding. It's like, we're not even out of, and I don't think we will be for decades, mm-hmm. the harm that people who supported police defunding did to our sense of safety and security and our real safety and security in Washington State. Okay, we're gonna get to comments and our closing sanity check coming up. First, our friend Zach Abraham at Bulwark Capital is the man to go to if you need a second opinion on your retirement portfolio. Zach and his team of analysts at Bulwark are constantly monitoring what's happening globally, nationally, and they are adjusting your retirement portfolio as necessary. And really, they look at it as healthcare. I mean, you would probably, if you had something significant going on with your health, you'd want to get a second opinion. And so that's what they look at it as at Bulwark Capital, as getting a second opinion when it comes to the health of your retirement portfolio. So you can get Bulwark's free Know Your Risk Portfolio Review. They will cover the impacts of the 2024 election, an outlook for 2025, and they'll give you a full reveal of how Bulwark is always looking for opportunities to lower risk, lower cost, give you as much upside as possible when it comes to your retirement. You only get one retirement, you want to get a second opinion. Schedule your free portfolio review now at knowyourriskradio.com, knowyourriskradio.com. Lucky Zippet, you are the most spoiled dog and you're just over here. What did you just eat? I hope it was a spider. Yeah. Can you just chill? Lax. She's so cute. Okay, comments, questions on the budget situation, which am I wrong to think that that's a kind of a silver lining? I really think this is a good thing. Some forced cuts, as long as they don't rely on new taxes to make up the bulk of that. That's the unknown. I just feel like that would be so politically unpopular to do right now and do to Bob Ferguson after he talked about in his ads how, like, you know, costs are hard for families. I don't know if they have the balls to do that.
Yeah, I mean, it's shocking to me that, I mean, it's not shocking.
Yeah.
But that Inslee was able to kind of hide this till the end of his term here and isn't after the funny? Election. Like to say this isn't the Democrats' fault, that he was able to, you know, hide it from Democrats' fault until after the election. And then we're going to, like, 2 months, like, put all of this, like, drama, we'll put it on Inslee, and then Ferguson can come in and be the hero that has to, you know, rescue Inslee's terrible budgeting.
It's so interesting because it is weird how quickly this came up. How it wasn't even
overnight.
It wasn't an election issue. We didn't really, it wasn't on our radar. In fact, Dave Reichert had ads talking about what a great budget situation the state was in, and so we needed to reduce taxes because we don't need any more money, right?
But I think he also said it's a spending problem. So well, he right, said right. we have there money. Our budget so
we
is
cut,
not
we yes. need to cut taxes, right. right? He was using that as a justification yes. for cutting taxes. Mm-hmm. And so it is strange that they, mm-hmm. they the media
played right into
it. Right, because then they started pushing it out to the media, mm-hmm. right? So now all of a sudden, like, you're telling me you didn't know until right after the election that we're going to face a $10 to $12 billion mm-hmm. budget deficit? That's interesting.
Yeah.
Why is it that I think that you're, that's probably what happened, is like, we got to shield this from being a Democrat issue mm-hmm. in the election, and then we'll drop it and be like, Bob Ferguson's got to fix it.
Right.
It's just ridiculous. All right. Let's see. Todd Welch, the new taxes, eventual income tax, will be sold as funding for education for the children. Seattle Public Schools is not shutting down schools. Instead, they will request fixing their $100 million deficit from the legislature.
That is what they've said. And, and that is wild to me that they're just going to kick this down the can and hope that voters have to pay for it.
100%.
It's wild.
Yeah.
Wild. I mean, I understand the parents are upset that these schools are closing. It would be a major change, mm-hmm. life change for these kids. However, you don't have the money. Like,
you don't have the money to operate.
You can't operate.
No,
so you have to figure out a way to handle it that doesn't it's just nuts to me that this is happening.
They have
we're
no
like, okay,
sense
never mind. Whiny parents. And so we're just gonna like say, well, taxpayers, you take care of it.
No sense. And then remember what we talk about all the time. They let things get so bad that they think you're desperate enough to approve new taxes.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what they do on public safety, etc. That's what they do with the mental health crisis, behavioral health. Like, hey, let's just let it get so bad. Lucky, can you not over there? I'm never bringing them again. Let's just let it get so bad. I do say that every time. Let's let it get so bad that people come crawling to us for help, and then we use that to justify new tax revenue. Mm-hmm. That's what happens. All right, let me see. Debbie says, why did several recent levies fail? The parents are just a tad tired of the teachers union using the kids as pawns. It is 100% not about the kids. It used to be, but not now. The teachers union, both local and state, have an agenda, and it has nothing to do with reading, writing, and arithmetic. Yeah, they always say, we're out here picketing on the first week of school for mm-hmm. the kids.
For the children.
My ass, that's for the kids.
Nope.
Crazy.
And I like what she's saying. People are finally starting to wake up to it. And I don't know. I don't think Seattle's going to get the money they think they're going to get.
No.
Or that they could get.
Where are they
going to
get it?
There's no money.
Right. Anybody who comes with an open hand to the legislature, this is not the year that you're going to get it.
Nope.
Because they don't have it to give to you. So it's just wild. Unless they pass your taxes. Kenneth, mm-hmm. unfortunately, Brandy, Democrats are great at creating new social programs. And when budget shortfalls come up, they hold those programs hostage in an attempt to force citizens to vote themselves new tax increases. 100%. That's what we just said. That's what they do. On Gurmai, Mo says, who with name recognition will run against him that would be more conservative?
I don't know what she's chewing on over
she's
there.
She's chewing on some sort of... Hey! It's
probably
get
something important.
I'm sorry, guys. I had to bring them today.
Silly dog. Who with name recognition will run against him that would be more conservative? First of all, no Republican can win in King County, obviously. I'm sorry, Mark Mullett has to run.
I hope he does.
Mark, you have to run. You have to run. Mark would absolutely win. So I just don't know what else to do about it. On Dow and Ice, Diana Manning says, I wish they'd take these costs out of Dow's personal finances. Yeah. Matthew Cook, Ice Ice Baby, stop, collaborate, and listen. Ice is back with a brand new edition.
Yeah, look at you.
100%. I know that song. You think I don't know that song?
No, I know, I can, you know, also the song. But
in addition to singing, I can also rap. Jackie McWalter Huff, seeing Lucky's tail wag in the background puts a smile on my face. It shouldn't. I didn't actually. Now she's eating something else.
Yeah.
The thing is that we can lock her in the other room, but then she sits there and she
whines.
I want to see you. I want to be with you. And so she just comes in here. Now she's just playing with something. We're almost done. Hold your horses.
You're spoiled.
Whatever you're chewing on, you must drop. She's so cute. I wish we had a dog camera. Let's get to our closing sanity check, shall we? This might be my favorite thing ever. So I don't know if you guys saw the video of Justin Trudeau down at Mar-a-Lago having dinner with Donald Trump, which is just crazy, right? So Justin Trudeau goes to Mar-a-Lago, and apparently Trump told him the business.
And tonight we're getting some new details about that Trump-Trudeau dinner from two people who were at the table. We are told that when Trudeau told President-elect Trump that new tariffs would kill the Canadian economy, Trump joked to him that if Canada can't survive without ripping off the U.S. to the tune of $100 billion a year, then maybe Canada should become the 51st state and Trudeau could become its governor.
Oh, Donald Trump, we're back, baby. I love that so much. He flew all the way to Mar-a-Lago to be told he could be the governor. of America's 51st state, Canada. It's great, eh? All right, that has been our sanity check for today. That has been today's episode of Undivided. Remember, you can gift a subscription to Undivided on Patreon if you'd like to. You got a family member or a friend who could use a little sanity in their life. Patreon.com/undivided/gift. So an easy way to do that. That has been today's episode. Thanks for being here. Thank you so much for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. Let's see what else we got going on. Regular live show tomorrow. All of that's good. Join us in our Undivided community. You can subscribe on Patreon, Locals, or X. A note for subscribers on Locals. Locals is having an issue with its video posting that they've been trying to deal with for the last few days. So if you've noticed anything funky, that is something on Locals' end. They are dealing with it. We are in touch with them. And hopefully we'll have an update on that soon. All right. We'll see all you guys back here tomorrow at noon.